of the Sunstone Symposium this year. The title of this panel discussion is Ethics, Historical Research, and Archival Policies, Deciding What to Restrict, What to Open, and What to Use. The panelists include Michael Homer, Ken Driggs, Jeffrey Johnson, and Harvard Heath. Michael Homer is a partner and director in the Salt Lake City Law Firm. He is a trial lawyer with a concentration in real property and construction litigation. He attended Georgetown University and the University of Utah, where he received a BA, and the University of Nebraska, where he was awarded a Juris Doctorate. Ken Driggs is a criminal lawyer in Tallahassee, Florida, where he represents death row inmates in their final appeals. He holds a Master of Laws from the University of Wisconsin, where his research focus was Utah law dealing with the parental rights of modern polygamists. He publishes regularly on the legal aspects of Mormon and fundamentalist Mormon history. He is a sixth-generation Mormon. Jeffrey Johnson, beginning in 1984 to the present, has worked for the Utah State Archives. He is currently the director of the Utah State Archives. Prior to that, he was a manuscript cataloger with the Historical Department of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Harvard Heath is the curator of Utah and the American West at the Brigham Young University at the Harold B. Lee Library. To begin with, and to set the tone for the panel discussions that will follow, each panelist will have about 10 to 15 minutes, and then they and I will, or other people in the audience, will be happy to respond to any questions that any of you might have about the subjects covered. I would, by way of introduction to the topic of historians, archives, and ethics, I would like to highlight some of the issues and concerns we hope to address this morning by appealing to my own experiences. Not quite 10 years ago, Ron Prittis and I began work on a book later published as Brigham Young University, A House of Faith. At the outset of this project, Ron and I decided that our time would be best spent by dividing the research between published and unpublished sources, Ron focusing on printed materials and me scouring archival and similar manuscript collections. For nearly 1 year, Ron waded page by page through BYU's voluminous student newspapers, reading more than 2 million words. I concentrated on materials housed in the Brigham Young University Archives section of the Archives and Manuscript Division at the Harold B. Lee Library. Given their importance to the history of BYU, I first requested access to archival personnel to the official papers of the school's presidents, beginning with the first three, Carl G. Mazur, Benjamin Clough, and George H. Brimhall. Because of the age of these collections, permission was sought only from the Director of Libraries, not the university president. Thanks to unusually detailed registers, I was able to go through these three collections fairly quickly. However, when I next requested access to the papers of Franklin Harris, library employees informed me, decided, that they on their own authority could not grant access and instead forwarded my request to ranking school administrators. Their concern was that the Harris papers possibly contained correspondence, etc., from living general authorities of the church. My request made its way up the bureaucratic ladder until it reached the desk of President Jeffrey Holland. Word was then eventually passed back down to the university archivist, informing me that not only was access denied to the Harris and subsequent presidential papers, but that the three collections I had just used were being placed under tighter restriction and would be closed to me in the future. This response signaled to us that the administration was apprehensive about the content of the final manuscript of our book and was, in fact, unwilling to cooperate with us as fully as we'd hoped. Fortunately, this presidential edict affected only those collections for which access had been specifically requested. Still available to us were more than 1,000 linear feet of college, departmental, and faculty papers. It soon became apparent that copies of many documents relevant to our research, the interaction between religion and academics, otherwise located in restricted collections, could also be found through the back door in these many unrestricted collections. In addition, we discovered that such materials were equally available in the university's own four-volume Centennial History and the authorized biography of BYU President Ernest L. Wilkinson, which had been completed in 1978. Initially, photocopying privileges were easily granted by archives personnel. However, as it became clear that copies of many presidential papers, particularly those of Ernest Wilkinson, were available in other collections, those privileges became increasingly difficult to come by. The reasons for this were never completely explained to me, since it seemed to make little difference whether I transcribed or photocopied a document, and I frankly doubt that this reaction was more than a knee-jerk response to the administration's concerns over the project. Shortly after this, it also became a policy of Archives to have an employee of their choosing go through the collections to which I had requested access and physically remove any documents that, in the opinion of Archives personnel, might be considered embarrassing or sensitive. Deciding exactly what this meant, of course, depended on the interpretation of the person going through each of the collections I asked to see. During this time, we also approached individual administrators, faculty members, alumni, students, and others to solicit their support and cooperation. Most we contacted were excited and enthusiastic about the project. In some instances, we were able to gain access to copies of important materials in private hands, the originals or copies of which were located in the restricted collections at the Lee Library. Almost without exception, access to these materials was granted on the condition that the identity of the person or persons sharing them with us remain anonymous. A number of questions confronted us regarding our decision to use these and other unpublished materials. Should we use materials from presidential collections to which we had once been granted access but were now closed to us and other researchers? Should we use materials from restricted collections we had obtained from supporters independently of those restrictions? How should we identify the location of otherwise restricted documents, especially when we knew they were located in the university archives? Ron and I decided to use all the materials we collected. Convinced that we were not bound by BYU Archives policies, since we had not gained access to them through official channels. We also believed that we were capable of using these materials responsibly, and especially that readers deserved the fullest, most complete account of BYU's attempts at mixing religion and academics. However, because of our decision, several rumors later surfaced on campus. According to one particular, for me anyway, one particularly slanderous story, which unfortunately has become a favorite with at least one BYU archivist, I endeared myself to Archives employees, gained extraordinary access to the closed stacks, and somehow managed to steal documents from under the diligent noses of watchful University Archives employees. Another story held at President Holland, putting his arm around my shoulder, granted me under-the-counter carte blanche to the university's official documents. A third reported that I had been disfellowshipped and or excommunicated from the church because of the book. Each of these fanciful stories was false, but trying to put them down proved to be as difficult and as frustrating as stomping out a brush fire. As a footnote to the foregoing, one of the documents I examined and made copies of were lists the presiding bishop's office supplied to BYU admissions during the 1960s and 1970s. The lists identified by name members of the church who had been excommunicated and the reasons for their excommunication. Admissions personnel were to cross-check these names against the names of applicants, since university policy prohibited excommunicants from enrolling. I believed that these materials, as sensitive as they were, could later be used by sociologists and demographers to study excommunication trends in the church. I accordingly deposited them at a public repository, assuming that they would be used appropriately. Just this year, however, I learned that these papers have been destroyed because the public archivists did not want to be burdened with the difficult task of administering access to them. Ironically, this same depository also has a microfilm copy of the church's massive journal History, which for the 1950s contains virtually identical information regarding excommunications. In many ways, I believe researchers and historians of Mormon history share problems similar to those Ron and I faced. Suppose a professor at a local university hires a research assistant to go through various manuscript collections in both public and private repositories throughout the state to collect materials for a book the professor is writing. The research assistant dutifully takes notes of and photocopies materials he or she feels the professor is interested in. The professor is a busy person and lets the research assistant do all of the archival work. After the assistant has finished, the professor finds time to work on the book and decides to use many of the assistant's notes and photocopies. Does the professor identify these materials as being the handwritten or typewritten notes of the research assistant, as being photocopies in the professor's possession, or as coming directly from the school's library? Can the research assistant keep copies of his or her notes and later write an article or book based on them? Suppose one of the professor's colleagues shares his or her research notes to materials the professor has not petitioned to examine. Should the colleague do this? should the professor use them? We'd like to turn the time over first to Michael Homer. He will be followed by Ken Driggs, then Jeffrey Johnson, and finally Harvard Heath.
Thank you, Gary. I thought I would just take a few minutes to relate some personal experiences which, quite frankly, have occurred outside of Utah and outside of the United States, for that matter, and just in laying some ideas of generally, I think the that it would be a good idea to develop some strong ethical ideas on access and also on use of archives. My experience has been that access is as different as the institution that you do research in. Most of my research as of late has been in either Italy or the United Kingdom. I have done research just in the last 2 months at the University of London, at the Society for the Preservation of Christian Knowledge, the Waldensian Archives in Torre Pellice, Italy, at the Biblioteca Nazionale in both Rome and Florence, and also the Biblioteca Quadriana in Venice. And it's interesting to me that in each place, different questions, different standards, and obviously different interests expressed by the individuals involved upon whom I was making requests for research. One example, I would not have got into the Biblioteca Quadriana in Venice but for the fact that several hours before I was searching for books, which is one of my bad habits, in a bookstore in Venice, and I was lucky enough to run into an individual who is coincidentally a member of the Italian Supreme Court. We began to discuss my areas of interest, and he indicated, oh, heck, I can get you into the archives, no problem. I couldn't have got into those archives but for his personal introduction. It's my understanding, based on just a cursory review of the law in preparation for this session, that there are really no state or federal statutes which control access to private institutions or private archives. But there are a few. There's the Buckley Amendment governing access to student records, and there's also an executive order on national security information which do apply to private archives. But other than those statutes, I'm not aware of any standard regulations that can be applied with respect to private archives. Nevertheless, it's my impression that private archives have been interested in the development of law both in the federal government and the state. And I'm sure those of you that are familiar know that the state of Utah has just recently adopted, and I'm sure Jeff will talk about this in more detail, regulations and statutes regarding access to information in the state archives. And it's my view that the private archives, both in this state and nationally, have been influenced to promulgate new provisions providing easier access to donated material because of the federal and state statutes which have been enacted, which by and large open access and attempt to develop a balance between rights of privacy and rights to know, which, if I'm reading the cases correctly, is the standard that is being developed in many of the cases. I believe that as a general rule, the archivists that I've dealt with, both in the state of Utah and nationally, normally are committed to the principle that everything in their holdings will eventually be made available for reference use, but they are seeking a balance between the public's right to know and the need for confidentiality. And I must be very frank that I have found all of the archives that I've done research in the state of Utah to be much more open than archives in Europe, for example. They seem, and notwithstanding Gary's introduction here, they seem to be much more protective of documents for whatever reason. And I believe it's one of the reasons is because there's a much stronger tendency in the European statutory systems to protect the right of privacy over access. And that's something that's, of course, different in the United States with the developing theory of right-to-know of individuals. There's no generally accepted definition of privacy which is applicable in all given situations. Nevertheless, privacy in its simplest terms is the right of an individual to be left alone, to live a life free from unwarranted publicity. And I guess it's the role of individual archives and archivists to attempt to define that term either through standards that are developed through the American Archivist Association or standards developed by case law in the United States or standards developed within the institution itself in order to determine what is private and what is not. Many institutions are more concerned about the possibility of publishing a libel by providing access to documents which are private. The definition of libel includes the defamation of both dead and living individuals, but quite frankly, as a lawyer, I'm convinced that it would be very, very difficult for any individual or group to maintain a cause of action against an institution of any sort, private or public, for a libel against a deceased person unless a showing was also made that a living person who claims some interest in the document which was made public could also claim that he or she was libeled. That, it seems to me, is an issue perhaps more with private institutions, both with respect to religious organizations and non-religious organizations, that needs to be looked at, and that is what is a libel, what is the potential, what is the interest for descendants of documents with of individuals who originated documents, and how do you balance that out? In other words, in my opinion, a party may only be held liable if the libelous material reflects upon and injures living individuals as well, and I'm not sure that that always happens, but perhaps the archives are overly zealous in protecting privacy rights, particularly in situations where family trees, obviously an example being in the LDS Church, are considered to be extremely important, particularly where families have held ecclesiastical positions for a long period of time. So overall, my view is that as the state and federal archives become more and more public, that is going to pull private archives, perhaps in some situations kicking and screaming, to make their documents more public and more available. And perhaps the same thing will happen in Europe, even though at the present time there's not the same tendency in the law to develop a more wide open and public access to those records.
We each have very different perspectives and orientations on this, so you're going to get a completely different part of the spectrum, I think, or landscape on this subject as we talk. I have a graduate law degree from the University of Wisconsin, where I wholly embraced a theory in legal scholarship that legal scholars call critical legal studies. The basic premise of that is that in law and in history, there is no such thing, and I'll put this in historical terms, as absolutely neutral history. History is political. History is advocacy. History is always reported from the viewpoint and the interests and the values and the concerns of the prevailing party. And that when history is later written, the prevailing party or institution or whatever has an interest in marginalizing the party that was defeated, the outside party. The prevailing party wants to write a history that shows why it is just or proper or correct or moral that their orientation or whatever won out, and that the losing side is less moral, is less able, less intelligent. And then sometimes the losing side will sort of bounce back and you'll get this revisionist history that tries to rewrite history. Anybody that looks at Mormon history, I don't think can have any doubt about that. portrayal of Mormons in the 19th century by the sort of majority national view was to marginalize us, to present us as immoral, ignorant, easily led hicks or whatever out here in the boonies. And in the course of Mormon history, there's been a sort of a revision as Mormons have tried to seize more control over their public image as it's presented through the history. And then a very different, radically different image is presented. If you think about history, you've learned, I grew up in the Deep South, and certainly the Civil War is portrayed down there. A generation or so after the Civil War, there's this great move to revise what the Civil War meant in history. And I gather a lot of history that's accepted by people now is sort of this Southern revisionist, Robert E. Lee is the great man kind of thing. And now you see a little bit of a trend back the other way as people are beginning to say, well, now maybe slavery really was pretty awful and we shouldn't be dealing with anything that tries to portray it otherwise. Anyway, I think institutions that are set up by prevailing interests, well, let me back up a little bit. These conflicts can come between cultural groups. They may have racial differences. They may have religious differences that involve friction between competing religious communities, socioeconomic groups. You see it in histories of the labor movement. You see it certainly in histories of the Mormon Church. You see it in histories of dominant church and its and their offshoot groups. You see it in histories of racial conflict. In my business, you see it in criminal law. When I represent death row inmates, we are very much involved in reconstructing or constructing alternative histories on these guys. I'm trying to present an image that's very different from the image and background that the state, who is seeking the execution of my client, tries to present. And history is a bit like that. So when you start talking about archives, I think unconsciously in many instances, the maintainers of those archives, some of the policies and the ways they're set up and the organization of material may subconsciously have the effect of advancing the interests and the orientation of the prevailing party, presenting the historical spin that they are interested in. And I'm not suggesting that archivists go back and read everything in their files, you know, and say, well, this is what we want to put out or alter things. I just think they're sort of subtle institutional forces that sometimes put a tilt on the historical sources that may come out of an archival institution. Sometimes these orientations may be viewed as concern for the reputations of predeceased individuals. They may be concerned about the privacy of current individuals. Concerns may be presented that there's really another agenda at work, at least a subconscious, subtle agenda that at least plays a role in the decisions about access to certain materials, who may have access to it, and what kinds of materials are accessible. I'm not pointing fingers, actually, when I say this, because I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the work I've done in archives in Utah, which has been pretty positive. There is probably, or I'm certain there is, a problem sometimes with bureaucratic administrators, people down the sort of functionary ladder, that may be concerned about how their superiors, ecclesiastical superiors maybe in a church context, but or political superiors in a public archives context, may react to the disclosure of some things. And there may be hesitation to disclose issues out of not so much concern, at least the people making the decisions, concern for the content of the documents, but concern for how they may be used and someone else's attitude towards their disclosure. I'll give you a little example of how I think this may play out sometimes. I published an article in the Utah Historical Quarterly, I think it's the winter issue. Probably no more than four of you in this room even are aware of its existence. But it concerned Vera Black and a 1955 Utah Supreme Court decision on the parental rights of polygamous parents. It was a distillation of my LLM thesis. And in the course of researching that at the State Archives here in Salt Lake, we were given access to some documents that just floored me because they indicated that the trial decision in that case was basically rigged in advance. There was a lot of ex parte communication with the trial judge from state officials in Utah pressuring the trial judge to decide a certain outcome on the case before he'd heard any evidence. There's a memorandum indicating this is how we will decide this case and all future cases in the future. And this polygamous woman and her attorneys were completely unaware of this communication and never informed of it. In effect, the case was rigged. And that case later became the basis of a rule of law in Utah that existed until the last couple of years, when the Utah Supreme Court basically overturned it without saying that they did. And there may well have been some reasons for those documents to not be quite so accessible. They were probably sensitive. I could foresee certain situations where, if there had been sort of political, social influences brought to bear on how some of these documents were made available, that stuff might not have been available to us. Like I say, I was very surprised when we found its existence. My general orientation on this personally is that all of these things ought to be made available, that history should sort of find its own level through an examination and study of documentary materials and other materials. I have one little personal rule about that relates to religion. I'm personally very uncomfortable with trying to use history to destroy the faith and religious conviction of another person. I personally view religion and faith as a positive thing, whether I agree with the religion and faith that I'm confronted with in another person. And I think when you destroy it, you haven't replaced it with anything positive. But I view that as a different thing from additional information that may put the source of religious belief in a greater context. An example of that I can think of is Mike Quinn's book on magic and Mormonism and early Mormonism that some of you may be familiar with. That's not the sort of thing that troubles me at all. I think it puts additional light on who Joseph Smith was and the world that he existed in. I don't see that as faith-destroying. But if one were to set out to try to empirically prove through historical documents that the Joseph Smith vision never occurred or that Jesus Christ was not resurrected, that's the sort of historical writing that I would be very uncomfortable with, and my own personal ethics would dictate that I not write up something like that. I don't think you would deny its access. I'm not sure I'd be anxious to disseminate access to the stuff if I happened to find that. Part of my thinking on that is that believers are going to believe what they are prepared to believe, what they have invested part of their soul and their testimonies in. Someone who is a committed Mormon, I don't think you could come up with enough documentation, no matter how solid you thought it was, to show that the Joseph Smith story was untrue. You're not going to change the mind of a believer, except people, I suppose, on the margins. On the other hand, if you reject Mormonism, you're like some hardcore Baptist like I live with in North Florida, there's no amount of proving I could ever give to them that the Joseph Smith vision or anything like that happened that's going to change their mind, that's going to convince them that this is a truism. So I just think there are some things that history is not able to prove. I should qualify all I've said with the comment that I've researched at BYU, the Utah State Archives, Utah Historical Society, and the Church Archives, and have generally had a pretty good experience with them. I've not had any problems. I've had free access to information. I've generally had free access to copying, although copying sometimes is an issue. Sometimes you can minimize the ability to use materials by not making them available to people copying. But I really don't have any complaints with it. I have done a lot of work on fundamentalist Mormons, and when I first started researching that and looking at it, I didn't say anything to the people I worked with up at the church archives, because I was just sure the door was going to close and that was going to get people real upset. And finally I had an article that was about to publish, and I figured, well, I better tell these guys so they're not surprised by this. And I did, and have had quite the opposite experience with church archivists. If anything, they have gone out of their way to make materials available to me. In a couple of instances, restricted materials. And my personal experience has been the opposite of what I anticipated. Maybe I was just too prepared to believe some of the horror stories that I'd been told. And I continue to work in that area, and I continue to get nothing but cooperation. I'm careful about what I ask for sometimes and try to be politic about it, but I have no horror stories to relate in that area based on my own personal experience. Thank you very much.
As Gary has said, I've spent my professional career being an archivist, About 25 years ago, I needed a job at BYU, and I started, was hired to catalog diaries at BYU. That led me to work for 15 years at the church archives. And in those early times, I really have fond memories of the commitment of the people that worked in the church archives. We felt like it was so important for us to identify and create finding aids to documents that later led to a lot of research. We were there a little bit before Camelot, but we felt like we helped the Camelot come on. I now am working at the State Archives as the director of the State Archives, and so I've been thinking about the issues of ethics and the archives for a long time. I think most of us interpret this as ethics of access. There are other ethics, and I have the Society of American Archivists and the Society of Canadian Archivists have ethic codes, but what I want to talk about is just the ethics of access, which is discussed in those codes. I think our modern society has created difficult questions that surround the issue of access to information. These questions have become complex as the amount of information grows. You give a great deal more information to government entities than your ancestors did. You give a lot of detail about your personal life. And as government grows and becomes more a part of your life, the information in government archives becomes about you is becomes huge. Society demands openness. Gone are the days when newspapers will refuse to show a president like Franklin D. Roosevelt in a wheelchair because the image that would give. Newspapers apparently decided that early on to not show him in a wheelchair. Those days are gone. In fact, we try to find the president in the wheelchair to show. And yet, society demands privacy also. Gone are the days of the yellow journalism. An example I'm going to use here of that is the published of unsubstantiated reports of the death from abortion by one of Brigham Young's daughters, Adele Young Harrison. The Tribune reported that without any sort of knowing the facts at all. But today that would not happen. Archivists call this the dilemma between the public's right to know and the public's right to privacy. And both of these rights have grown, both legally and in our moral sense, much more than they were in their past. Like I say, our ancestors did not have the same issues. To deal with this, the public records law in Utah was recently revised and went into effect July 1st of this year. And I spent for 6 years often in a room with lawyers and other people, bureaucrats, trying to develop a law that would deal with these two issues, that we would have open government so we could understand what our governments were doing and also have privacy. I believe that this is a good law that was developed. A lot of people don't believe that, and maybe you've been reading in the paper where Murray City was having a problem with it, and Salt Lake County and Grand County, all over the state, people are having problems with this law. But we worked really hard on it, didn't we, Gene? Gene White was on the committee. I run across an example that I really love, and I just like to use this example. The American Libraries Association has strict guidelines about their libraries. These guidelines push the policy that libraries are created for access to information, and that it's very important that this access is equal. And they have very, very strong guidelines there, except they have strong statements that protect library records. In other words, you can go to the library and find out who and find out anybody else's information, but you cannot go to the library and find out their own circulation records. The reason, they say, is because they don't want you to know people's privacy what books they checked out. They don't want to tell the government who's checking out books on how to make atomic bombs. So, and these are one of the few records that is very strongly restricted here in Utah, our library records. So it's ironic to me that this organization that is so open decides that library records must be closed to protect the public and protect our privacy. Professional ethics for archivists requires balancing the conflicting interests of relationships unique to archivist occupation. The needs of donors and collectors do not coincide with those of researchers. Also, the administration of the repository and its parent institution operates at times under certain constraints that conflict with these professional ethics. Desperate interests must be taken into consideration when the archivist sets policy and standards. Many of the elements of this balancing act are familiar to archivists, and I've just got a few here. Delicate negotiations, often with very difficult donors, may have difficult restrictions on their papers resolved after you've had these negotiations. Excessively long and inadequate restrictions on papers and the attendance problems of the selective access. I'm going to use some examples in a minute about this, but I think all of us know of papers that the donors were completely unreasonable, and one reason they are is they don't want to give up control over who sees their papers or who can control it. I remember archivists talking, we used to have a theory that we needed to have a system like they have in India, or they did have in India, where they would throw the widows on the fire. We thought they should throw all the widows of great people and spouses of great people on the fire and kill them and all the children, because these people are the people that cause a lot of problems for archivists. And we could give you examples of widows and children who have caused us a lot of problems. Okay, another problem is overzealous researchers who use any means, honorable or otherwise, to gain access to legitimately privileged papers. And there's really a lot of examples of that in Mormon history. Researchers who have lied, who have used other permission, or have footnoted things in an incorrect way so that they could cover up using closed papers. Another one is archivists who have employees that disagree with institutional policies. That's very difficult for an administrator when your employees become closer to the researcher than they do the institutional's policies, and that's always a problem. Also, we have problems with competitive scholars who battle over this intellectual property and academic turf. There are scholars who do not want to share material with other scholars. So archivists get caught in the crossfire. Maybe just to kind of summarize, your institution that you're serving oftentimes is a problem for you. The staff that you're serving is oftentimes a problem for you. And your researchers are oftentimes a problem for you. So I guess everybody is against the archivist. I have three kind of issues that I want to talk about, is the inequality of selective access. In public archives, that the Utah State Archives is, we feel like it's very important that everybody has access, equal access. If something is closed, it's closed to everybody. If something is open, it's open to everybody. We have no right to to put people in classes and to give, in a democracy, give a certain class of people more access than other. A famous case is the Francis Lauenheim case at the Franklin D. Roosevelt Library. In this case, a researcher sued the library because the library had kept material from him that another researcher had. And the judge, and the case was finally solved by saying the researcher was right, that there was no reason to keep material from one researcher and give it to another. Another problem, though, is access to restricted collections. And I found a really complex case of that, and I don't know how many of you have ever heard of this, but this is the Sigmund Freud papers. There were really three collections of papers, and they interacted in such a way that there became a lot of problems. Sigmund Freud, till a few years ago, had a daughter who was alive in England, and she had a lot of her father's papers. There was a man from Switzerland who was very committed to Freud and collected a lot of his papers and donated those to the Library of Congress here in the United States. The Library of Congress collected papers too, and they dealt with a great deal of negotiating with donors. When researchers wanted to use this material, it became so complex they felt like the only way they could do it is to lie to Anna Freud who they were. And so this became a problem because they used material from one of the collections and footnoted in another collection and lied about what they were doing. And the Library of Congress was in the middle, and there were editorials in the Washington Post saying the Library of Congress is trying to protect Sigmund Freud. And it was really the collection that was in London that was having the problems. I'll just hurry on some of these. Access to open collections, you might be familiar that Ferdinand Marcos of the Philippines was embarrassed by material that was in the United States National Archives about his role in fighting the Japanese in World War II. And Kurt Waldheim, of course, was embarrassed because of material that had been collected after World War II about his work as the Nazis. Well, this is research that was in open collections that embarrassed important people, and it wasn't collected to embarrass them, but it became an access issue, and both the United States and the United Nations were criticized for this material. I'd just like to tell you one of my concerns, and that is that I think in this society we're developing a tendency to not keep the material that would have great candor. In the past, Anna Freud felt like she could keep the material about her father that was embarrassing because she had some control over it. Now she doesn't, or before she died, she didn't feel like she had any control over it. Other people will probably learn that message and start destroying the material. We feel as archivists that we see more and more papers come in cleaned up, and in fact, I'm aware of general authorities who have advised other general authorities to not keep documents where the old general authorities used to keep them. I think it's a result of what's happened in archival issues here in Utah, and I hope that we'll deal with them better. Thanks.
I will come from a different perspective than the other three. I will try and address some of the issues that archivists deal with on a daily basis to better hopefully inform you of why things are as they are. Initially, I need to tell you that archivists are always misperceived. They're these bad guys. One of my colleagues years ago at a convention tried to have us underscore by telling the audience the difference between an archaeologist and an archivist. An archaeologist is someone who discovers and uncovers buried treasure. An archivist covers and buries it. And this is a perception that I think too often obtains in our society, that we're out there to restrict, to cause grief for those who want to research. And in particular, I think today's session is basically an attempt, I think, to address the issues that the LDS Church and BYU Archives seems to have, a perception that they are somehow atypical of archives. I was glad to have Michael express to us here his views on the international archival situation. I've been in England and Germany, and the archives there are impossible to work with compared to the ones here in the States. If you think that BYU or the church is restrictive, you ought to go over to Europe and try and use one of their archives. Very difficult. And in that many respects, too, I think that we as historians and as archivists come from two different perspectives. We as archivists have certain standards to uphold and to maintain, and the researcher feels that he should have carte blanche and doesn't understand why things are in place. Let me begin by stating a few things in response to the questions raised in the article here. One, why do we acquire and restrict collections? Why is the policies, upon what are they based, and why do we do it? And is BYU as a private school different from, say, the University of Utah or Utah State or any other state archives? First of all, let me just spell a couple of things I want to do initially. BYU archives are primarily staffed by historians. Myself, Dave Whitaker, Jim Dark, Graham Baker, Albert Winkler all have PhDs in history. That was our initial interest vocationally. So we understand the researcher's point of view. We're there to help. We've been also involved in cases where it's been very unpleasant to work in archives, where they've been uncooperative, difficult to work with. So from the outset, we understand the needs and want to accommodate in any way possible. Always make an evaluation, first of all, is their papers really worth it? Do they have enough to offer us in terms of a diary or papers that makes it worthwhile to store it? Because you must realize that every time we take a collection at any institution, there's a cost factor there, even on a donation basis, which is very prohibitive. We have to bring it in. We have student time. We have professional staff time. We have storage. We have insurance. There's a lot of money involved in taking a collection on at any given institution. So first of all, we make the determination, is it worthwhile for us to take that? When that's been done, then we have to say, yes, we'd like to have it. Now, what are your concerns? And invariably, if it's an important person, they're going to say, okay, I want to know three things. Who's going to use it? Who determines that? And when it's published, what rights do I have on what comes out of that? Unless you're very competent in telling these people that you'll preserve their wishes, they will take it somewhere else. And increasingly, as mentioned here by the panel members, privacy is a concern these days, more than ever before. And people are concerned about having their papers distorted or used improperly. And I find it very, very interesting that generally we talk in very absolute terms about free access. Yeah, should be. Yeah, I agree. But when it comes to your own personal papers, then it becomes very relative all of a sudden. Well, yeah, but in my case, I'm special, and I have these certain concerns I want to have addressed. And one of them is, let me take a couple of case in points. President Wilkinson, who we all know and love or hate. Here's a man who kept records in unbelievable detail. As an attorney, he would never have a conversation either on the phone or somebody where he didn't afterwards either record the conversation there or take a quick note either written by himself or dictated to the secretary. So he had a voluminous correspondence file as well as a diary. And he was very outspoken, and he described meetings with general authorities, with important business leaders, politicians, and gave some very personal evaluations of those meetings. Now, he had no regret about the candor he used in writing those things down, but he was sensitive to what that might mean to a family member who might come across that. So, in his will, he stated that I will give them to BYU on the stipulation they'll be held for 25 years without being used. Many cried foul. You know, that's not fair. I mean, if he's a public servant and public official, he ought to have his stuff open to inspection. But he felt that there were people still alive who could be seriously hurt by having those kinds of things out. And again, it's a question of how you come to this question ethically. Do you feel that a person has a certain privacy, or does he not have privacy? And to what extent does he have it, and to what extent should it be cut off? It's a difficult question, and no one has the answers to apply to every situation, every case in point. In Wilkinson's case, the question has been sitting there, and we as an archivist have to determine two things when a question comes in with this kind of a problem. Is it worth it to store it and keep it and arrange it for a quarter of a century before you can use it? I mean, it's very costly. Is it really worth it? And in many cases, we'll tell the donor, I'm sorry, unless you give us open access right today to be used, we feel we can't take your collection. It's just not worth it, us to obtain it, maintain it, and let it be used on that restricted basis. And we've had many cases where that's occurred the last 5 years where people say, hey, here's my conditions. We have to tell them, I'm sorry, we don't feel that's worthwhile. But in his case, it was, because it's a veritable history of the church for a number of decades. However, there have been people who wanted to use his papers, and the family person in charge, David Wilkinson, has allowed that to happen. And it's been used more and more. And the question I think you have to realize here is, and maybe it's unfair, Jeff raised the issue of open access, equality to all. Unfortunately, we can't do that for a number of reasons. Let me give you two cases on that. One, let's say we have a collection that is brought in, and it's a large collection, and it's going to be a while before it gets processed. It's sitting there in boxes, and a student comes in and says, hey, I've got a thesis due here next month. I want to. I heard you have these guys' papers you got last month. I want to go through them and for my dissertation or my thesis or my senior paper. He'll be told no, because processed collections have to be used. Unprocessed collections can't be used for a number of very important reasons. One is the student is an unproven quantity. He could go in there, rearrange stuff, and cause problems with provenance that we could not allow. However, if a seasoned scholar who knew this type of thing, and we've had many in the past, Tom Alexander, Mike Quinn, come in to use our collections unprocessed, we know they know how to treat collections. They know the importance of provenance. They know the importance of maintaining the collection as it was, and we make exceptions to those people. Unfair? Maybe it is. But we feel that the larger responsibility is to make sure that collection is maintained properly, and we know that those who are serious scholars who have a proven track record, we can give more latitude. And granted, it's unfair, but we have to do that to preserve the collection. We've had too many cases where we've allowed that to happen where unqualified researchers have gone into a place, taken boxes, and totally destroyed it. We've had to go back and take months to try and get it back together again, and in many cases, the provenance is lost forever, and we have no way to recover that. So there is a sense where it is unfair that those who are proven scholars do get better access. There's always been a problem at BYU over the years with Chad Flake, who we all know very well. Chad's kind of an old, crotchety old man sometimes who has very strong views on who should and who shouldn't see things. Yet there are people on campus who can walk in the door right past the guards, sit down there, go up the stacks in the back there, pull stuff out and read it. These are people who Chad trusts and feels that they can handle it, and he does it. If you tried that there, you wouldn't get past the front door. Granted, it's unfair, and unfortunately, archives are different, and there are things that occur which make it perhaps unfair. But by and large, I think that, as Jeff mentioned, we have standards set up by the SAA and others which give us a code of ethics, and we try in every way possible to accommodate those who want to use collections. And I suspect that some of the concerns we have here in this state are because of the horror stories that come out. Gary's is a case in point, but I would argue that Gary's case is not typical of a research project, I think for obvious reasons. I won't go into that, but I think that Gary's case is different. And I find it also interesting that in Utah we have more bad press about Utah archives and people who live and work in the state than from the outside. We rarely have a complaint for people who come outside the state to use the archives at BYU or anywhere else in the state. They're always very surprised and happy, and we have a stack of letters of appreciation for our help. Yet people locally find reasons to carp and complain about being uncooperative and over-restrictive, when in many cases people find that our places here is much more open than the places that they've been elsewhere. And so, again, I think it's a perception in Utah that we have that Utah, it's a conservative state. We have this cloistered secret societies that abound here, and we can't have this free, open access to things, and therefore we have this perception that we are really out of step with the American mainstream archives. And in reality, we're not. We're, in many ways, I think, ahead of some of the things. And there's also the problem that I think you often realize that archives have traditions. And people who were employed there for many, many years tend to become kind of, powers in themselves, and they dictate policies which are unfair and unreasonable. And the only way you can solve that problem is to wait till they retire or pass away. And this is not only happens here in Utah, but it happens elsewhere, where you have people who have certain views on how things ought to be run, and they draw some very unfair policies. At BYU, we've been very concerned about our image, and have tried to keep our policies as open and above board as possible. The only problems we have BYU and other places where you have materials that are generated by the parent institution, the university or the church, that goes into what we call university archives, which is private correspondence between administrators on campus, and that is off limits to everyone unless you have a serious research endeavor, and that has to be approved by the president. This looks at the outset as being very restrictive and unwarranted, but again, that's their professional archives. They have things said there that were meant to be said and done with certain people in closed rooms. And when you find letters that come in and say personal and confidential, not to be seen outside this this group of people, and it gets out, you can appreciate their concerns. And no one here in this room here really would be any different. At the risk of, well, no, I won't give his name, but we have a very prominent professor at BYU right now who I know personally, a good friend of mine, whose papers are coming to us, and he's probably one of the most open people around. And he's concerned about who's going to see his papers. He has letters in there from people about other people, which were rather personal and revelatory. He doesn't want those out to anybody. Not because he's embarrassed at what he said, but because in the wrong hands, by the wrong people, used in the wrong way, they give a distorted view of that. And he doesn't want to have to fight that. So he's asked that we have certain portions of his collection restricted for a certain time. And if that's restrictive, so be it. But we feel as archivists we have to honor the donor's obligations. And I don't feel that's really unreasonable if you look at it from the broader perspective of individuals. We all tend to want to have everybody else's records open, but our own, we tend to be a little more, I think, careful about that. So in conclusion, I just want to state that there are good reasons why there are policies set up, and they're not always fair and not always right, and are sometimes abused, but we try and endeavor to make sure that we give everybody equal chance to use records, and that we give them the best possible service and access to those who inquire. But when you find a place where there's a problem, an obstacle in your way, in most cases, it's not the archivist who's putting that in your path. It's the donor or a policy in place which has to be honored. So I would hope that you would take a more enlightened view of Archives in Utah and realize that we're trying our very best to give open access and to serve the public in a way that will be helpful to all. Thank you.
We have about 30 minutes now for questions from the audience or questions from individual panelists directed to other members of the panel. I have some questions of my own that I'd like to ask, but let's turn the time over to the audience. In view of the fact that the session is being recorded, if you could state your question clearly, and if it's directed to a member on the panel, make sure that we know who that is, and then members of the panel, if you wouldn't mind repeating that question into the microphone.
I'm not sure I can repeat that question. I think it the in general, and tell me if I'm summarizing it incorrectly, Levina, can the church archives claim a copyright on manuscript materials? Is that what we're talking about?
It does claim copyright.
Yes.
Yeah.
And let me just say at the offset that I'm not familiar with either the argument or the policy that the church has, but just generally, it's my understanding that in 1976 there was a change in the copyright law, and a lot of manuscripts were grandfathered as a result of that. And let me just give you an example, because I'm familiar with the estate of Arthur Conan Doyle. He died in 1930. His copyright would have expired normally in 1980, so everything that was unpublished that had not entered the public domain would have expired in 1980, but for the fact that there was a provision in that act which that extended the period of time, I believe, well into the second decade of the 21st century. So clearly, documents that were still unpublished and had not entered the public domain in 1976 can be claimed by institutions such as the LDS Church for copyright. There's no question about that. The second thing is that institutions can claim copyright on the organization of documents, including manuscripts, how they're organized, editing, footnotes, etc. And there's no question that if documents are organized in a certain way, put on microfilm and made available, that organization can be subject to copyright as well. Other than that, I'm not familiar with, for instance, if we're talking about a document from the 1850s, for example, that has never been published or never entered the public domain, obviously there may be circumstances or situations under which copyright could be claimed, but I think you'd have to look at it really on a case-by-case basis.
This is really a thorny issue, and I know the SAA has had three different task forces in the last 10 years to try and grapple with this issue, and it's very complex, and apparently from what I get now is that until some court cases are tested, there is no way we can really determine that. I think the J.D. Salinger case a few years ago really kind of scared us all, or he won, and a severe limitation was placed on that. So my impression is right now that with the explosion of technology and all the problems that it brings to us, that right now we're kind of in limbo on where this stands. I think until some court cases are tested, we don't know where we stand in terms of who has these rights.
Jeff, how would you like to restate that question? And then
you're asking about documentation of children of some of John Taylor's wives. Well, I guess what I need to do is to tell you my experience. I've been studying Brigham Young's wives for a long time. And some of those wives were married in places and times when documentation was very sketchy. And so it isn't as if the church isn't acknowledging them. The church didn't know about them. The other thing is that I've been doing research on Brigham Young's children. I gave a paper on that, and there's three of them I can't find a lot of data about their marriage date because they didn't have any children. To have documentation, you have to do things that people will write down and in a way that they'll write down. So I'm sure this doesn't really relate to that, but it's difficult to do research in family history. We were able to add one more child to Brigham Young's list by a diary that mentioned that Louisa Beeman had a baby that died. So these things are not that the church trying to keep them with them, as there was no records kept at that time, except I haven't been able to find them, and I've been working and for a long time on this. I've been able to find on Brigham Young's wives in the endowment house records the things, but the wives that were married on the plains and like that, I had to find them in diaries. So that's my experience. Yeah, and I think we're talking about sealing records here. I have the same on one of Brigham Young's wives. I have the divorce, but not the marriage. And I assume that, in fact, I think I've found that they were married in winter quarters, and there were just no records kept there.
I have a case with the A.L. Smoot family. I'm doing some work with the family, and he had four wives that everyone acknowledged. But And this is a very strong family in terms of genealogy. They have a very strong group that meet annually, 2,000 of them. They're really nuts for genealogy and trying to find information. In the last 2 years, they've discovered two wives that they didn't know that he had. And the reason why, the first one was, as Jeff mentioned, Mary on the Plains, divorced in Salt Lake City in 64, and he kept her there, paid her needs for 30 years till she died, but never ever acknowledged that out of deference to her. The second wife was married in Logan on a weekend in 1880 sometime, and the family, for reasons of embarrassment, kept that from their other family members for over a century. In just the last few years, have they acknowledged the additional two wives, and they've gone back now and tried to find the children and trying to do that. So in many cases, there's many problems that occur here in trying to unravel why they became unknown and hidden. That's really a detective's job to try and unravel why they were not recorded, or if indeed at all they were married.
I have a slightly related comment on that. I started looking at these marriages and prosecutions from 1885 and then some post-manifesto ones, and I have a sense, I don't have any proof of this, but I have a sense that there was a deliberate effort not to record a lot of them out of a fear that the records would then be obtained by federal prosecutors and produced in a court to facilitate a prosecution. And I suspect there may have been some personal reasons with some controversial figures in church history and post-manifesto not to record and to create that trail, possibly because of problems they had with their brethren over the issue.
I assume you're talking about later. I don't think that was true in the period that we were talking about. I do not believe that they didn't record them because they didn't want them recorded. I found one of Brigham Young's wives. She was dying in the wagon, and she said, "I want to be sealed to somebody." Her sister writes this. And so Brigham Young came, and she says, "I want to be sealed to you, Brigham Young." Well, she was sealed to Brigham Young. That was enough for Brigham Young. He didn't feel like he needed to write it in any book or anything. And she died 4 days later. I don't think he tried to cover up that wife or anything. I just think that he went on with his life.
Other questions? Jesse.
Well, I was the one that let them be open. We have very strong feelings at the State Archives and the strong law that says unless there's some reason for these records to be closed, they should be open and available. As we reviewed that, we felt like there were no reason to close them. I hope that... And I don't think it'll be true. I have this concern that bureaucrats will start saying, well, if the archives are going to open these, I will start throwing away my records. But we just do really have the strong feeling and a strong law. And why we have it in the United States is that we're very strong about democracy and that we should know what our government is doing. In Europe, they have a tradition of not that same tradition.
Yeah, on that point, let me just relate an experience with one of the daughters of Arthur Conan Doyle, which I found quite interesting. I was having lunch with her, and she made mention of the fact that she was very upset that she had two brothers. They're both the offspring of the second wife of Conan Doyle, that one of her brothers had sold letters written from Conan Doyle to her mother. And she went to great effort to obtain those letters through an auction, and then she said, "And I did what I had to do. I burned them." So, what Jeff indicates here, I don't think is totally far fetched, should be of some concern, I would think.
That's an interesting issue that talk about ethics here, especially if you have a case like we've had in the past where you have a person come in with a great collection. They say, "Okay, I will take this and give it to you, but I want these letters taken out, and I want you to destroy them. I want them shredded or give them back to me." And as an archivist, what are your obligations? Well, you say, "Oh, obviously you take care of the donor. I mean, that's their request, and you honor it." But in many cases, these people are not all there. These are old ladies who say, hey, you know, I don't want that brought out about my brother and his affair with so-and-so, or dad's letters to my mother. They were at a bad time. So what do? I know archivists who have a view that they say, okay, they will photocopy them and give them back to the person and keep them in the drawer till they pass away. That's an ethical question I'm not sure I want to deal with. But it does happen. I mean, what are your obligations? We have a case in point now of an important collection where this is going to come to a head. They have a large collection they want to give to us, but they want certain letters taken out and destroyed because they feel they convey an improper picture of their mother and father's relationship. And they're afraid that someone is going to distort that. And so the condition is, you will give you the whole thing minus those letters. Do you take it? And if you take it, do you honor their obligations? I mean, these are very tricky issues. And you really wonder at times how ethically you should behave in these situations. Because they are so personal, they can't do it themselves. You know, it's funny about letting go. They don't want to let it go. They want to have it done, but not by them. See, somehow they're not culpable if we do it.
To repeat the question for the tape recorder, the Church Historical Department does maintain at the entrance to the library and the archives a guard station, and the guard does have a list of people who have been banned from archives. Some of the repositories will grant access, although limited access, to certain scholars and not to all scholars. I guess the question to the panelists is that something that should be changed, and if so, do you have any strategies for trying to achieve change along those lines?
I was just going to say that if we volunteer an answer, we may be on the next list, so we should be.
That's why I can talk. I'm not worried about that. I first think that we have to be honorable, and I think it's sad that that guard's there too, and it bothers me. But I think you're going to have to admit that there are reasons that guard's there, and there were reasons that when we weren't honorable. I'm not saying we in the sense of me or any of you. And so, to me, somebody who is bad and mean and doing things you don't like, you treat them honorably and nice and loving, and that's the way I think Christ taught us. That makes me sound very Pollyanna, but I don't think that there's anything that these people on the panel can do to change policies at the church archives, except to just be honorable in the things that we do and to work hard to fulfill our ethical responsibility. And I really do have a problem with inequality of access. And I've seen so much of it during my tenure as an archivist. I really hate it. I think it really is not an honorable thing.
However, though, I think it's important to realize that it's not just the church archives that has a problem. We had a case at BYU for 20 years. We have a very large and very important collection of Custer correspondence from the George Camp collection. It's very valuable. And we had a Custer file from back east who'd come there periodically and take stuff out of their photocopy, take it back to his archive in Chicago and claim it was part of his archives. And we sent him letters saying, this is illegal, you can't do this, you got to acknowledge where... And he constantly would do that, wouldn't acknowledge our letters. And you know, what do? You make a big scene here and say, hey, you're not welcome here, ban this guy from using these anymore. And when people take advantage of the system, you begin to wonder what your obligations are. The person who gave us that collection wanted us to be given to us, and we would acknowledge it as part of the BYU archives, and it was to be acknowledged in that way. Here was a guy who came in, took stuff out, and refused to acknowledge where it came from, and claimed it was part of his own personal collection. So do you ban this guy from coming here anymore? What do you do to a person like this who abuses this privilege? He's a well-known person in the country. So these are issues that are hard to address. It takes just a few guys to ruin it for everybody. And And unfortunately, institutions can use these cases in point to say, well, you see, we have people who we can't trust, therefore we have to have these policies. And it hurts us all. But I'm not sure that, as was mentioned here by Jeff, that we are in a position to help at all. At least at BYU, we have legal justifications to honor commitments, and we don't have the problems the church has. But I'm not sure that the church can really make much headway until things change up there. And that's the absurdity of it all. I mean, you're right. I mean, there's a case in point where we have a microfilm of the School of the Prophets minutes, which are at BYU. If you go to Salt Lake, to the church archives, you'll say, I'm sorry, that's restricted. But go to BYU, they have a copy. I mean, it's kind of absurd, really. And not only happens at BYU, but other places have copies of these things. And there's so much interleafing of different correspondence files that really pertain to all places that it's really a shame that we have to have these bifurcated here and there. When I was doing the history of BYU, the authorized version, Gary, the best archives for BYU is at the church archives and the church education minutes. I mean, there's just literally reams of letters dealing with BYU education, and we can't see them because they are in the church archives, but they pertain exclusively to BYU matters. So I agree with you. It's a crazy system, and I wish it would change.
What Harvard didn't say, too, is that Wilkinson kept his own copy of the Board of Trustees minutes, and
this is a great story. Leonard here can appreciate this because we came aboard about the same time. Leonard became church historian, and I recall Leonard, hey, you know, keep pushing up there all you can, because we had gone to the church to get information at BYU, and at that time, this is being taped, isn't it? I can't. Well, let's put it this way. President Wilson said there are certain people in Salt Lake who are going to deny you access, but they might pass away soon. And if they do, we'll go back and ask the next person in charge, which indeed happened. And we all of a sudden got access to records that had the big R marked on them. And for 3 years I was up there, and they were mostly innocuous. I mean, they had no reason to have R's on them. But Wilkinson, we got to the point where he came to his administration, and we said, President, we're having a real problem here. We got denied access to the Board of Trustee minutes. He says, how come? Oh, they feel that's too contemporary and too many people are still alive, and so you can't have them. I said, well, geez, what are we going to do? He says, I've got a set in the back. Come use mine. And so in many respects, those of us find, as Gary, I think, found out, that there are other copies around, and this is, I guess, what breeds the infamous Mormon Underground, that when you have access denial, it breeds these types of underground activities.
The church archives are housed in the east wing of the church office building. The library is on the main floor, and the archives are floors up from that. Well, I had a question similar to yours, Dan. Let me phrase that to include what you just asked about, and then Ken can answer for himself if he felt like he was granted special permission or something. I would imagine that most of us here would tend to favor open access, and I assume that as a given. But I was wondering if each of the panelists would address the question about what's the best argument that you could come up with for restricting access to a collection of a deceased individual. Yeah. Do each of you believe that the church is handling its own records and the records of its members properly?
I'd like to use the argument that I think the church archives would use about your first statement, and that you said that these old records weren't given under any restrictions, and so why are they being restricted? I think their argument would be is that the people that gave those records intended there to be closed to research, or intended them to be some sensitivity to it. And an example of that is if you wrote Brigham Young about very personal things, you didn't know that 100 years later your descendants would be reading those things, or your descendants' neighbors, or things like that. So I Well, they wrote Brigham Young not because to record that they had done evil, but they wanted his opinions. They wanted his advice on what should I do in this case. My wife has committed adultery with our neighbor. I still love her, but can I deal with this? How can I deal with this? See, all these records. Okay, what I'm doing is addressing something specific, Brand, and that is that people, when they created these records, didn't intend them to be used, in most cases, as historical records. My grandfather's diary didn't intend that when he wrote it. So you have to be sensitive to their intention. I'm not saying that it's appropriate to restrict them. I'm just telling you what the theory is behind that. And answering Gary's question, how's the church archives handling the records that are my heritage? I have a lot of problems. I worked there for 15 years, and I disagree with a lot of things that are happening there right now. And I spend a lot of my time and energy trying to make that an open place. But I do honestly believe that they're doing the best they can under difficult circumstances. And there's issues that the archivists are trying to deal with that are issues that they're trying to deal with in the Freud case and in the Library of Congress and archivists all over the nation. And so I'm not going to criticize them until I can do a better job of dealing with those issues.
Of course. If I might clarify a little bit, when I got access to that restricted material, I think surprised is the right word. I was surprised that they had the material. Having learned they had it, I was even more surprised that they might be available to me, because I suspected they would have actually more controversial stuff than they proved to have in them. If it were up to me, I'd make all that stuff available, frankly, but I'm not charged with that responsibility. And I do agree with Jeff that I think the historians I'm dealing with are doing the best they can. Well, I guess I should put it this way. You know, I'm from Florida. I'm not out here in Happy Valley, so I get different kinds of information, bits of information about all this. And I had heard all the rumors and horror stories about how all this stuff was hidden away and I would have trouble getting with things that I perceived to be relating to uncomfortable topics for the church. I perceived that this topical area was uncomfortable for the church. It may not be as uncomfortable for the church as I thought it was, or they may just have a thicker skin than I thought. But I have encountered none of the horror stories that I've heard circulating around, and my opinion about their existence is shifting a good bit based on my own experience up there. Well, I mean, that I'll admit that I've been a little careful about some of the stuff I've asked for, but I've also been surprised at some of the stuff I've gotten. So it may well, but right now I have no complaints with my experience with that.
I guess my comment, there was a reference made earlier to sort of the combination of archivist lawyers on the panel, and I guess my feeling about perhaps why there are restrictions for some documents and aren't others would be what every trial lawyer experiences, and that is that you can take the same facts from the same documents and come up with totally different conclusions. And yeah, let me just indicate something, though, that I find quite, and that is that, and I'm not arguing for restriction, don't get me wrong, because I favor openness, but taking it from the side of the institution, and obviously there's going to be an effort on the part of every institution, and certainly the LDS archives are by far not unique at all. In fact, if you've ever taken a look at the Jehovah Witnesses, even if you attempt to write a history, you're automatically excommunicated in that church. So, I mean, we have to take into account really where we are on the spectrum here. But what's interesting is that if you look at most documents in a legal trial, and obviously discovery rules are very liberal, that you're pretty much given anything that is quote-unquote relevant to the process that you're involved in. except in criminal cases, but I try to avoid those, particularly my own. But it's interesting that many documents that are discovered through the process of document production may lack foundation. In other words, there's no evidence because of hearsay or other legal principles. In other words, the document does not provide any basis for forming any opinion on any subject. And I would think that part of the problem that historians have, although I'm not a historian myself, is the fact that many documents, particularly written many years ago, can be taken out of context. And one thing that a trial lawyer learns very, very early is that the only evidence that's really worth anything in a trial is verbal evidence through cross-examination. That's when you really learn, because you can take a document that's been interpreted both ways by a party, by one party and then the other party, and you're really never going to know what that document means until you cross-examine a witness on the stand. Now, obviously, you can't do that when you're talking about history, because unless, of course, we buy into the spiritualism and we can bring the person back. And yeah. And I don't disagree with that. All I'm trying to do is form some idea as to why the policy exists. I'm not saying it's well-founded, but it would seem to me that that is a concern, and obviously documents have been discovered, taken out of context, and different things can be written about them, destructive to the institution, and I would think that that's one of the reasons that there are restrictions. Yeah, I am not disagreeing, but I don't think that one can say that there's absolutely no rationale for the policy, is all I'm saying. But whether or not it's a justified rationale is another question.